A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
The West's unilateral sanctions and attacks against different countries around the world have had a boomerang effect on the Western countries themselves. According to reports, supply chain disruptions caused by the war in Ukraine, rising fuel costs, and the impact of heat waves on crop yields have all contributed to increased costs for producing and processing food. Farmers have been unable to boost supply, leading to expectations that costs will remain above the levels before the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Global food companies have paid out nearly £15 billion to shareholders. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. The website of Common Dreams noted the world's biggest food companies have paid out nearly £15 billion to shareholders as spiraling prices leave desperate families struggling to afford to eat. Open Democracy revealed. Nestlé, Unilever, Associated British Foods, Mondelez, and Archer Daniels Mill & Company, ADM, have raked in £20 billion in profits in the space of a year while all raising average food prices. Four of the five multinationals, which between them own thousands of popular brands such as Twinings, Kingsmill, and Cheerios, have all signaled consumers should expect further price rises. Only ADM has not. The firm's profits would be enough to fill £9.8 billion funding gap twice over that is currently facing the United Nations World Food Programme, WFP, which aims to provide food for 160 million people facing poverty by the end of the year. The WFP said it costs 44% more for it to buy food than it did in 2020. The bonanza for food corporations comes amid a 40% increase in the number of people in the UK forced to turn to food banks since April, according to Trussell Trust. The charity, which supports food banks nationwide, has warned it can no longer rely on donations to meet rising demand for energy food parcels. Frédéric Mousseau, an economist who has worked for international relief agencies, including Oxfam and Action Against Hunger, told Open Democracy, "How can we accept that a handful of corporations record such huge profits while you have billions of people who are already struggling to survive?" Food prices in the UK have increased by an average of 16% in the past year, with the cost of some staples, such as bread and milk, rising by a third. The prices of vegetable oil and pasta have soared by more than 60%, the highest increases among the lowest-cost groceries tracked by the Office of National Statistics. The UK's biggest producer of vegetable oil, Edible Oil Limited, is jointly owned by American grain giant Archer Daniels Midland and Princess, a UK subsidiary of Mitsubishi Corporation. The former has seen its profits rise by 48% this year and paid out the equivalent of £1.5 billion to its shareholders in dividends and share buybacks in the first half of this year alone. The UK's highest-grossing food company, Associated British Foods, ABF, has also paid out £500 million to shareholders. This month, ABF's chief executive, George G. Watson, who will receive £2.2 million in remuneration this year, told investors at the firm's annual results presentation, revenues benefiting from prices increases and operating profit was solid. We've had to recover a huge amount of input costs from customers that don't like giving you price rises. We've done that job really well, but it's not finished. Some food multinationals have claimed they have tried to soften the blow to consumers when passing on costs. Nestlé chief executive Mark Schindler said the company had made a point of acting responsibility with price increases when announcing its half-year results in July. Nestlé reported half-year profits of £4.5 billion, 11% fall from the same period last year. But the firm has paid out £8.5 billion to shareholders in the form of share buybacks this year, while raising prices by up to 7.5% on its products, which include a top-selling baby formula. These corporations are very adept at rhetoric that doesn't have a lot of substance, Philip Howard, a professor at the Department of Community Sustainability at Michigan State University, told Open Democracy. They talk about balance, but if there is a choice between increasing their power and doing the right thing, increasing power is going to win every time. That's what the shareholders demand. Unilever, a British-Dutch multinational that also produces household cleaning and personal care products, has made £4.3 billion in profits this year, a 4% increase on last year. The company told investors it has raised its prices by 12% to cover increased costs. At the same time, it has paid out £1.3 billion to shareholders. The UK snack firm Mondelez, which owns Cadbury, has reported a 10% rise in profits this year, bringing in £6.9 billion. The company has handed £2.8 billion to shareholders in the form of share buybacks and dividends, while raising its prices by 11% in the last quarter. The shareholders who own these companies expect growth every year and a return on their investment. Maybe that makes sense for companies selling phones or TVs, but food is not a commodity. It's what everyone of people depend on to survive, and these corporations' need for ever-growing profits poses existential questions for humanity, said Musao, who is also a policy director at the Oakland Institute, a U.S. think tank. Supply chain disruptions caused by the pandemic, the war in Ukraine, rising fuel costs, and the impact of heat waves on crop yields have all contributed to increased costs for producing and processing food. But food experts argue excessive commodity speculation rather than shortages remains largely to blame for spiraling costs. A Unilever spokesperson said, in this challenging environment, when we are facing the highest input cost inflation in over a decade, making price increases is not easy, and we are very mindful of the pressure that consumers are under. We always take a responsible and considered approach to pricing, and there are a number of levers we pull to offset input cost inflation, such as promotions, pack sizes, and ingredient changes. A Nestle spokesperson told Open Democracy, "We are absorbing cost to tune of billions of dollars as reflected in the notable decline of gross profit margin. We have been doing everything we can to find cost-saving measures, for example, cutting marketing expenses and finding new efficiencies in production and distribution. Our priority remains to ensure that consumers have affordable access to the products and brands they know and love while still paying fair prices to our suppliers, including farmers and small companies for their sustainably produced raw materials." A spokesperson of ABF, which reported £399 million profits from its grocery division for the year ending September 30, a 3% decrease on the previous year, said, "We strive to make our food as affordable as possible. Like a lot of businesses, we are encountering extreme inflation and increased energy prices. Last year, ABF had to absorb inflation of £1 billion, and the group will have to absorb the same amount in the current year. As a result, we have unfortunately had no choice but to increase prices to retailers, and despite this, the margin in our grocery business is clearly down. Businesses have no choice but to pass costs on where they can, give the scale of the inflation. As we sell to retailers, we do not set the shelf price for goods, the retailers do." Mondelez and ADM did not respond to a request for comment.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Bahrain has made history, but for the wrong reasons. Bahrain's King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa met President Isaac Herzog in the first visit by an Israeli president to the Persian Gulf island. From there, Herzog went to the UAE. The Abraham Accords has made these visits possible, U.S. brokered agreements that ushered in the so-called normalization between Israel and several Persian Gulf Arab states, including the UAE and Bahrain. Now, as much as Israel would like to show that its relations with Persian Gulf Arab countries is flourishing, well, the citizens of those countries and the wider Arab world are vehemently against that and have vowed to never recognize Israel. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Leif Maarouf, activist and political commentator, joins us from Beirut. Also joining us is Saeed Nimr, who's a professor of political science, joining us from Bursait University from occupied Ramallah.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Laith Maruf, I'll first start with you over there in Beirut. So you have this visit by Isaac Herzog visiting for the first time at the invitation of the King of Bahrain to that Persian Gulf island. Now, according to what we have resourced to meet members of the local Jewish community and some senior government officials, and along with him, he's taken a business delegation to meet Bahraini business people. But that doesn't sound like something that other Israeli officials couldn't do. Why do you think then it was him and the purpose of his trip going to the Persian Gulf island of Bahrain? It seems like it would be more than that.
Well, of course, this is happening at the same time as the World Cup in Qatar is happening, and we see Herzog is not visiting Qatar, he's visiting Bahrain and the Emirates on both sides of Qatar after the public humiliation that the Israeli media received from the fans, local Saudi, Qatari, Emirati, Bahraini fans that rejected any interviews with the Zionist media and stood up for Palestine. We also have to remember for the last 3 days before the visit of Herzog landing in Bahrain, the Bahraini population was out in demonstrations on a daily basis, showing that they reject this normalization and collaboration with the enemy of the Palestinian Arab and Muslim people, the Zionist colony. And in fact, Herzog had to change all his local events and agenda inside Bahrain in order to hide himself from the population, and had to cut down his meeting in Bahrain to the bare minimums. When they say he's meeting with local Jewish community, what they mean is foreign Western Jewish people that are in Bahrain. There is no Jewish Bahrainis, and there's definitely no Jewish Emiratis.
Indeed. Well, Sadner, maybe we need to really dive into how bad this, I guess, feelings that came out during the World Cup against Israel, and how people, I mean, it wasn't just like people saying, oh, are you an Israeli media? I don't want to talk to you. It wasn't like that. People were angry when they found out that it was an Israeli reporter that wanted to talk to them. Can you explain to us the hatred that was displayed there in many instances when this happened?
In reality, we have to differentiate quite obviously between the rulers in the Arab world and between the people. The people never ever lost their compass towards Palestine, towards Jerusalem, towards the issue of the Palestinian people, and against Israel as a colonial project in the Arab world. So the feeling is a genuine one. It's a real one among the Arab people in general, and that explains the lot of humiliation that the Israeli reporters had just came. And in one of those incidents, it was from Moroccan people who just, you know, refused to make an interview. And the reporter said, but we have peace process between us and your country. But, you know, it's like, you know, they were trying to fit somehow, but definitely the Arab world was against. And this is quite normal, because as I said from the very beginning, there is a different between the rulers and the people themselves in the Arab world. Now for Yitzhak Herzog visit, we have to understand something in the Israeli regime. The president have no fact or real power in politics. It's just a public relation. And I believe that part of this visit, it's a kind of public relation, and try to fix a little bit the image, because all the articles and the media in Israel in the last week was focusing on how Abraham treaty or peace process that they were announcing with the Gulf states particularly is a total failure. And it's, you know, a treaty only with the rulers and not with the people. And the people, in reality, they hate them. Because of that, it's a kind of a public relation kind of visit. It won't take any more, you know, even any kind of political power or importance.
Sure. Well, I mean, I'm curious, Laith Maruf. It's supposed to be a public relation move there by Israel. Laith Maruf, are you with us? Okay, great. I thought we lost you there for a second. If it's supposed to be a public relations move, So how would the Israeli president display the success of Abraham Accords? I mean, what can he say? Because there's obvious detachments when it comes to Palestinians and what they're doing to them, and of course then amongst themselves, the Israeli presidents or officials with the Persian Gulf Arab countries. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, clearly he's dragging with him all the Israeli media to go to Bahrain, and specifically to counter the media image that appeared from the ground in Doha, in Qatar, during the World Cup. And I'm going to take this chance right now to say congratulations to all the African, Arab, and Muslim people for Morocco beating their former colonizer, Spain, just in a beautiful game. And Morocco, of course, was the last African, last Arab, last Muslim team on the ground. And Morocco, as being a country that supposedly signed normalization, its team was carrying the Palestinian flag on the ground, on the pitch, just now after they beat Spain. Their crowds were carrying the Palestinian flag everywhere, and Palestine was the biggest winner with the win of Morocco and this World Cup.
Okay, looks like this time we may have lost Mr. Laith Maarouf. All right, so maybe it's a good time, Saad Nimr, to ask you if you can please explain to us what this so-called Abraham Accords was, what its goal was, and how it's doing.
Well, you know, the Israeli and behind them also the Americans who pressurized the Arab countries to go ahead with these kind of treaties in order to bring it out as a kind of a success to Israel and to the peace and to all this kind of media issues. During Netanyahu's period, it was a kind of giving Israel some glamorous image around in the world, that they, in spite of what's going with the Palestinians or against the Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza and in Al-Quds, Jerusalem, but Israel is really keen for the peace, and they are willing for the peace. So they came out with this idea of the Abraham Accord, establishing that there is no differences between you know, Muslims, Christians, and Jews, because we are all descendants from Abraham. And the Israeli do concentrate a lot on Abraham, and you know, even some of the settlements in Hebron called Abraham Abino, our father is Abraham. So they focus on this issue and saying that all religions came out from descendants of Abraham, which is basically, from their point of view, the father of the Jewish religion. However, regardless of all that, it's just a name to make sure that, you know, we are living in peace between all religions, and its religions is not in kind of in contract with each other, or in contact with each other, or in a conflict, let me say, with each other. And it's time to make peace, especially in the Gulf states. However, the Israelis all the time, their eyes were on the Gulf. They always there, especially on Saudi Arabia,
sure,
and other bigger countries, even in the Gulf state, not in Bahrain and Emirates, though Emirates is very important economically. But they were always looking to that. And I think even in 2002, the Saudi initiative for normalization in return for the land which is occupied by the Israelis in 1967, including Golan Heights, was the issue here for the Israelis. They always talked about normalization first, and after that we will think of other issues, such as, you know, pulling out from the occupied territories.
Well, the Abraham Accords, Laith Maarouf, in a matter of speaking, it was something that was introduced, and correct me if I'm wrong, it was accompanied by this Bahraini economic incentive or initiative, which the former president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was a key architect of, which that didn't really spice things up enough, because it was evading the reality of the matter. But moving down this Abraham Accords, I'd like to get your thoughts on the fact that this plan, I mean, we need to touch on this, based on one of the lead negotiators, which was a general from Puerto Rico, who had said the plan was that if we get, I'm quoting him, the plan was that if we get everybody around the Palestinians to recognize Israel, then where does that leave the Palestinians? They'll have to come because they're on an island. So that, from the get-go, showed the real goal behind that, which is not something that's really highlighted.
Oh, yes, definitely. The whole goal was to isolate the Palestinians, similarly as happened in 1992 with the Madrid Agreement. The Jordanians broke off and forced the Palestinians to be standing alone, and they made the mistake not to stand with Syria at the time in rejecting the Oslo Accords. Now, what we saw really right now is that Israel is the one isolated, is the one that is an island in a body of humanity that rejects its supremacy. And this, although the Emiratis and Bahrainis were supposed to throw their money on the Palestinians to lift them up, supposedly, so they don't fight back, they didn't do that. They didn't throw their money on the Palestinians. They threw their money at the Israelis. Without the trade that the Emiratis are doing right now with Israel, the Zionists will be in a real big problem. Just now, the numbers yesterday came out. Almost a quarter of the GDP of Israel has been purchases by the Emirates, specifically of the blood diamonds stolen from Africa and cut in Israel by Israeli jewelers are now being sold in the Emirates for crazy amounts of money. So, no, the Bahrainis and the Emiratis are not doing anything to help the Palestinians. They're doing things to help themselves because they think, as dictators of Bahrain and the Emirates, they think that they can only survive if they hitch their ride on the Zionist colonizers. And believe me, I think they're going to be trying to hitch a ride on the planes leaving, like in Afghanistan, when the liberation of Palestine happens very soon, inshallah.
So since we're talking about Saad Nimr, the UAE and Bahrain, one of the reasons that Bahrain is said to be interested in wanting to go ahead with the so-called normalization with Israel was because it was trying to pretty much escape the human rights violations that it has exercised a minimum from the year 2011 onwards, which we know includes torture, detainments, etc. I'm sure you're well aware of that. But in particular, the UAE, I mean, what was the reason for them to also want to join in the two of the Persian Gulf Arab countries to, at this point, have done that?
Well, yeah, okay. There is many aspects here. First of all, we have to differentiate between Bahrain and Emirates in their situations, and we'll explain that. The second thing is that the American pressure, and especially during Trump administration and his son-in-law Kushner, and they make a big pressure in favor of for Israel, as a favor for Israel. And also we have to understand also the nature of what was going on and the nature of what kind of agreements between Bahrain on one hand and on EU with Israel on the other hand. Now, the first thing is that there is differentiation because this is the economic situation in Bahrain is very bad. It's not that good one like EU. And at the same time, as you mentioned, the what happened during the Arab Spring in Bahrain, which always kept away from the world media, and no one wanted to talk about the revolution that happened in Bahrain, and the intervention came from Saudi Arabia by sending the troops to Bahrain to sit down the uprising there. The situation there, it means that the people, as you mentioned, the human rights record, the people who are not happy with the regime, the attempts even till today in order to throw out this regime, and the demonstration that is always not covered by the media in general, especially in the Arab world, it's all that indicates that the Bahraini are in a big problem in a way or another, and they want to get some international attention, saying that we are, you know, peace lovers when we are okay with Israel, and Israel is very much accepted, mm-hmm. And especially to make sure that the American are happy by, you know, usually talking to Israel and having this kind of peace treaty with Israel.
Okay.
Now, for the Emirates, it's different issue. Sorry for my long statement, but the Emirates is different. They want to invest. and they are trying to enlarge their scale of trade, and especially with Israel also for their own reason and for economic reasons. It's more than important than Bahrain.
Well, there's something else that is most likely going on here. The death of Elaith Maarouf, perhaps you can shed light for us. And that is the fact that the UAE years ago was noted to be a hub for spies. I mean, the CIA had actually set up shop there. And we know that when you talk about the U.S. and intelligence and then the CIA, we have to talk about Shin Bet and Israel. And I'm guessing you obviously can tell us more, that there is a wide cooperation that's happening between Israel and the UAE in particular. We could talk about how they have done that in Yemen, on that island, where they have jointly now have a center there. Is that the goal or from the Israeli side to want to get in intelligence-wise with the UAE?
Yes, of course, the UAE has played, a little bit nicer with Iran, allowing much trade to happen with Iran. But this is part of the plan to make the Emirates a hub where they can monitor activities. If Iran will be breaching the sanctions and the blockade on it, which it should, then the Americans provide an out for that to at least monitor most of that so they can see who they want to target or what's the infrastructures that are financially that Iran is using. And now with the banks in the Emirates being a hub for trade, the Israelis coming in will increase this levels of monitoring. The Israelis also are offering weapons to the Emiratis. Doesn't mean that Iran was ever going to attack Emirates. Iran is not an aggressive country. But this is also to give the Emirates an advantage over the Ansarullah government in Sana'a in Yemen that is threatening to attack Emirati targets as long as the Emirati occupation and the Israeli occupation of Socotra continues.
I got to ask a quick question here because this goes back a couple of years. If you recall the time when Israel was very keen on not wanting the UAE to be sold these F-35 fighter jets, where it opposed that sale to the United Arab Emirates because it said that it wasn't sure about the superiority that it has and the edge that it has, that it would be threatened. It did go ahead afterwards. I guess that sale was done. Why was Israel so intimidated by that?
That's yeah, funny. Well, obviously the sale went through, but it wasn't delivered.
Really?
So the money has been taken from the Emiratis. I don't think the Emiratis will ever see those planes.
Uh-huh.
And the Israelis objected because they like to keep house slaves in their place. They don't accept an Arab the collaborator to think that he's equal to an Israeli.
Sure. All right, Saad Nimr, let me come to you now. This is quite interesting. I want to ask you about this particular character by the name of Ben-Gvir. He's the incoming national security minister, okay? Now, what's interesting about this guy is the fact that there was a meeting, I guess, not a meeting, there was a summit or a get-together in Israel, in Tel Aviv recently, of which he was present there along with the UAE ambassador. And he shook hands with the UAE ambassador. They somewhat embraced each other. But then he went around boasting about how he has made peace with Arab states without making concessions. And that to him, peace without concessions, it seems like it's a favorite line with Israeli, politicians. Is that accurate? And what does that say about the UAE?
Yeah, this is exactly the case. What do they mean to make peace without concession? What kind of concession could Israel give to the Emiratis or to the Bahrainis or even to the Moroccans or all other Arab countries who had already normalized relationship with Israel? The concession is about, the rights of the Palestinians, the rights of the Palestinian in their own land. So he means that we did this without being able to give anything to the Palestinian back or to help the Palestinians. We have to understand that Ben-Gvir himself, he's a settler and he's one of the most vicious settlers in the region, and he had so many episodes of attacking Palestinians as a person before he became even member of Knesset and later on member of Knesset. And now he's going to be in the government and he's going to be in one of the most important ministries, which is the Ministry of National Security. They changed even the name to national security, and they give him more responsibilities
sure.
in this ministry to and his ideas about, you know, to kick out all the Palestinians. It's an ethnic cleansing mentality for the Palestinians, and he want to kick them out in order to create more and more settlements.
Sure.
Now, that for him is to make peace without giving any concessions to the Palestinian, definitely something it's, you know, worthwhile for him to be a kind to celebrate about.
So extreme is he, Leith Maruf, that even members of the Biden administration have said that they're not going to engage with him. Now, either they're playing, either they're putting this facade, or they're really sincere about it. And, of course, given that if this is so true about him, what does that say about the future of the way Palestinians are going to be dealt with because of his role, the role that he has, his direct control over that?
You know, Ben-Gvir's political party is called Jewish Power, in the, you know, same shade as White Power. And it's very important for all of us to repeat the name of his party as often as possible so people can understand what we're dealing with. And along with the religious Zionist party today, who received the Deputy Minister of Defense position, a woman from one of the hilltop settlements in the West Bank. She's been filmed shooting at Palestinians before. They will be Ben-Gvir and the, so the Jewish Power Party and the Religious Zionist Party together will form a new militia of 200,000 colonists. They will, that are already
on. Okay. Got it. I think we lost you, Leith Maruf. I'm sorry, but at the same time, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank Leith Maruf. Sorry about that. Leith Maruf, activist and political commentator. And Saad Nimr, thank you, professor of political science at Birzeit University. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikko Vatavoy and the team. It's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Iran says the use of unilateral sanctions as political leverage impedes humanitarian work across the globe. Multiple civilian fatalities are reported in Ukraine's latest shelling of downtown Donetsk. Also coming up, the US planning to boost its rational military presence in Australia. Welcome to World News Live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Now, top story, Iran has once again condemned the imposition of unilateral sanctions by some countries against others and their use as political leverage in bilateral relations between states. Iran's deputy ambassador to the United Nations made the remark while addressing a General Assembly meeting on humanitarian aid. She described unilateral sanctions as a major obstacle to international humanitarian efforts. Iranian diplomats added that such sanctions are also a breeding ground for all kinds of human crises across the globe. She also voiced Iran's concern about deviation of humanitarian aid as well as non-humanitarian activities undertaken under the guise of humanitarian aid. And Iran says it has dismantled a number of operational cells affiliated with the MKO terrorist organization. In a statement, the intelligence ministry said the cells of saboteurs were smashed in the provinces of Tehran, Isfahan, and Kurdistan. It said the elements of those cells were arrested, adding that they were involved in terrorist activities and mortar attacks on Iran's administrative, military, police, and residential centers. The ministry said those terror activities caused damage and insecurity in the country. It noted that all those cells were directly guided by European base of the MKO terrorist group located in Albania. The intelligence ministry also reported the confiscation of a huge cache of weapons and equipment used by the terrorists. Iran says the recent riots in the country were fomented through foreign interference and represented a hybrid war against the Iranian people. Now Western countries, the US in particular, are trying to pressure Tehran by using human rights as a pretext for removing Iran from the UN Commission on the Status of the Women. Tehran has slammed the move, calling it illegitimate.
Tehran has slammed Washington's move to push a draft resolution aimed to remove Iran from the UN's Commission on the Status of Women. Iran's foreign ministry says any misuse of the internal developments in Iran to exert political pressure on the country is condemned and unacceptable. Iran has just started a four-year term on the body after a recent voting session by the UN Economic and Social Council. Tehran has repeatedly warned that some Western countries are exploiting human rights for their own political ends. In recent weeks, rioters went on the rampage across the country, brutally attacking security officers and causing massive damage to public property as Western powers, especially the United States, provided support. The European Union and some Western countries have imposed sanctions on Iran over its approach toward the riots. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said that the US and certain European countries are behind the political and illegal draft resolution and that they are seeking to exert pressure on independent countries to pass it. He said the US move is an action against the free vote of countries in international organizations and structures and questions the legality of such mechanisms in international bodies. He added, there are member countries of the UN Security Council or the Human Rights Council and Human Rights Assemblies that committed countless crimes against governments and independent nations throughout their history and now use human rights tools to exert pressure. Iran has lashed out at Western officials for cheering rioters in independent states while suppressing peaceful protesters in their own countries. Iran's foreign ministry says countries that have coups, conspiracies, interventions, and devastating wars with millions of deaths in their history are now pretending to be defenders of human rights in other countries. The best example would be Western countries' hypocritical behavior vis-a-vis protests in Iran and their own states. Western officials say the protests in Britain, Germany, France, Canada and Australia are bad and deserve severe confrontation, but riots in their targeted countries are good and deserve support.
Iranian officials have criticized the U.S. over its push for removing Iran from the UN Commission on the Status of Women, saying that they are acting dictatorially under the name of women's rights. Tehran has vowed to use all of its political and diplomatic capacities to prevent that move.
The riots in Iran began after the death of a young woman named Mahsa Amini in September. She collapsed at a police station in Tehran and later died at a hospital. Since then, the issue of women's rights suddenly caught the imagination of the world. The self-proclaimed human rights champions in the West, who turn a blind eye to gross human rights abuses in the US and Europe, are accusing Iranian authorities of killing the woman, even though all evidence, including the forensic report, scoffs at those claims. The Islamic Republic has strongly censured several countries for provoking riots in the country through their spy agencies and propaganda apparatus. London, in particular, hosts several anti-Iranian networks, including Iran International, Manoto, and BBC Persian. The U.S. is pushing for the removal of Iran from the UN Commission on the Status of Women, following trumped-up claims by foreign media that attributed the killing of women to the Iranian government during the recent unrest in the country. They claim that they are acting in defense of women's rights, but they are in fact violating those rights and preventing women from raising their issues through pushing for the removal of Iran from the UN Commission. The 54-member UN Economic and Social Council is expected to vote on December 14th whether to oust Iran from the commission or not.
Anti-Iran media networks are reporting a three-day strike by Iranian shopkeepers as part of the recent unrest in the country. But in Tehran, shops remain open and people are busy shopping these days, our correspondent reports.
According to foreign-based news channels, a three-day strike was supposed to sweep across the country from Monday through Wednesday. But a quick walk around the streets of Tehran, especially its Grand Bazaar, shows the shops are all open and people are busy shopping for their own needs. There are videos circulating on social media purporting to show some shops in Tehran's Grand Bazaar closed. People say, however, that these shopkeepers have closed their shops in fear of vandalism. In some cases, rioters have rendered shopkeepers unable to open their shops by putting glues on their locks. Also, there is news that unknown gunmen have opened fire on some trucks whose drivers were not willing to stop working during the three-day strike. Meanwhile, Iranian Judiciary Chief Ghulam Hossein Mohsen Ejei has warned that those who threaten or force sellers close their shops and join the strike will be identified and prosecuted.
Look around here. All shops are open. Thank God people are doing their daily shopping. This is a message to London-based media outlets. We are Iranians, we love our country, and we have unity. What you broadcast on your TV channels are mere lies.
Before coming to the Grand Bazaar for shopping, I had been told that there might be a strike. But as I have walked around the streets, I see no sign of a strike here. I think those who call for strikes are only making fun of themselves because a majority of people do not care about them.
The country has been gripped by riots for 10 weeks now, with the unrest claiming the lives of civilians and security forces.
The Islamic Republic says foreign media outlets are overstating what's going on in Iran to fan the flames of unrest. Officials are now calling on rioters to calm down, warning them against playing into the hands of Iran's enemies. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Pro-Russian officials in Donetsk say six civilians have lost their lives in Ukraine's latest shelling of the city. According to the city's mayor, the rocket and artillery fire targeted residential houses, an indoor market, a shopping mall, a youth center, and a cathedral in downtown Donetsk. There have also been reports of a few injuries. In the meantime, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky visited the frontline region of Donetsk on Tuesday. While meeting with his troops, Zelensky described the east of Ukraine as the most difficult front. Russian authorities accuse Ukrainian forces of heavily shelling Donetsk, but the Ukrainian side denies its aims to harm civilian or civil population. The two sides have intensified their attacks in recent weeks. Moving on, EU finance ministers express frustration with Hungary for blocking billions of euros in financial aid for Ukraine. Hungary is at loggerheads with Brussels over claims Budapest is flouting the bloc's rule of law. Jerome Hughes reports from the EU headquarters in Brussels.
EU leaders are furious with Hungary for blocking an 18 billion euro financial aid package for Ukraine, the first tranche of which is due to be released to Kiev next month. Finance ministers from the 27-nation bloc came together on Tuesday to try and resolve the impasse, but the meeting ended in failure.
Ukraine is a country at war. It desperately needs our support, and we just cannot allow one member state delay and derail this EU financial support.
This debacle follows a European Commission proposal last week to freeze 7.5 billion euro in funding to Hungary from the EU budget amid claims that Budapest is not meeting the bloc's rule of law standards. Aside from Ukraine, EU finance ministers have major problems closer to home. The energy crisis in the EU, resulting from sanctions against Russia, is getting worse by the day. The European Commission warns of economic disaster if EU nations continue to subsidise high energy costs in an ad hoc emergency fashion. Out of control, energy prices are making the cost of living crisis in the EU unbearable for households and businesses. Eurozone inflation is at 10%. The European Central Bank is aggressively increasing interest rates to try and tackle the problem. Economists warn forcing inflation down too quickly can also be dangerous.
Of course, if you have a persistent drop in prices, people might think, well, I'm not going to buy now. I'm not going to spend now because prices will come down. So I'm going to stay with my money in the pockets and wait for later. And of course, you don't have economic activity.
Croatia will become the 20th member of the Eurozone next month. EU finance ministers say Zagreb will be able to enjoy all the benefits. However, the euro has a troubled history, and so it's clear Croatia will also be exposed to potential risks during these incredibly uncertain economic times. Jerome Hughes, the EU finance minister's meeting, Brussels.
Turning elsewhere, the United States and Australia agreed to deepen their military ties, citing shared concerns over China's actions around Taiwan. Following their annual talks, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the U.S. will increase rotations of its air, land, and sea forces to Australia. For now, no details are available about the time of the deployment or the number of troops, ships, and aircraft involved. The two countries have also agreed to invite Japan to boost its military cooperation. Austin cited China's rise around Taiwan, as well as in the East and South China Seas, as the reason for the collaboration. Last year, the United States, Britain, and Australia formed a new military alliance called AUKUS under the pretext of boosting security in the Indo-Pacific. But China says the increased militarization and the buildup of foreign troops in the region is a threat. Democrats seem to have solidified their slim majority in the U.S. Senate, with projections showing the party will win the runoff race in the state of Georgia. Democrat Raphael Warnock is expected to defeat Republican Herschel Walker. Neither candidate was able to get more than 50% of the vote in November's general elections. That means Democrats will gain control of 51 out of the 100 seats that were up for grabs in the Senate. With Republicans landing the majority in the House, the latest win gives President Joe Biden more leverage with his legislative agenda during his next 2 years in office. The results from the Georgia runoff has also delivered a blow to former President Donald Trump, who is seeking to run in the 2024 election. Many of the candidates he had endorsed have ended up losing, including the one in Georgia. Turning now to Argentina, where Vice President Cristina Kirchner has been sentenced to 6 years in prison for corruption. An Argentinian court has also given the former president a lifelong ban on holding public office for a $1 billion fraud case. Kirchner has been found guilty of awarding public work contracts during her presidency between 2007 and 2015. She's dismissed the charges, saying they're politically motivated and unproven lies made up by her enemies. She's unlikely to go to jail as she enjoys immunity due to her government position. The vice president, who is the wife of former President Néstor Kirchner, is expected to appeal the court ruling. And Indigenous Canadians seized the moment at the COP15 Biodiversity Summit to protest against the federal government's crimes against First Nations people. A group of activists disrupted Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's speech at the opening ceremony of the summit in Montreal. They beat drums and unfurled a banner that read "Indigenous genocide equals ecocide." They called on the government to stop invading their lands if it wants to save biodiversity. Last year, the remains of hundreds of children were found at the sites of former residential schools in Canada. The harrowing discovery has led to demands for accountability. Thousands of Indigenous children vanished at schools mostly run by Catholic Church that aimed to assimilate them during the 19th and 20th centuries.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamate began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar, Muhammad ibn Ali, al-Barakat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet, the Messenger of Allah. He was also the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, with his talents, his genius, and his great endless scientific ability, has proven the luminous reality adopted by the Shia that an imam must be the most aware and virtuous one of the people of his time. And it has also proven that the one who has more knowledge than anyone else must be the imam, regardless of whether he is young or old. Allah the Almighty has provided the infallible imams of the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them all, with knowledge, wisdom, and sound judgment, similar to how Allah provided the prophets of the past with these same concepts and qualities. Truly, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam has shown this reality to all of the world. These are his dialogues.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are at your humble service talking about the dialogues of Imam Al